LPD 1041.
Signal 10 assistance.
Inside the Squad, presented by the Lafayette Police Department. To serve and protect is not just a motto, it's our mission.
Sending another unit.
Step it up.
Welcome back, Inside the Squad. Today we're talking about digital evidence forensics. That's admittedly way over my head, so I'm glad we have some guests with us today. We've got Paul Heff, who oversees our civilian CSI, Matthew Federick, who's a civilian CSI, Alia Storm Justice, another civilian CSI, and then Dr. Marcus Rogers from Purdue. So thanks for joining us. Glad to have you guys. Let's start first with what is digital evidence? What are we talking about today?
Digital evidence is anything that's digital. It goes from data from cell phones, data from computers, videos from our digital video recorders, information that we get from service providers like call detail records or call records, data from Facebook, Instagram, Snapchat. Any of that information that's in a digital form is something that we acquire, analyze, and use as evidence.
So is digital evidence, has it been around for years, or has it just grown over the years? I mean, has it always been around?
Well, it's been around for a long time. It's not always been utilized by law enforcement until recently. When I first started 28 years ago, we didn't always see it. Things were still analog. We get video that was saved on VHS tapes, if we've had it all. Then computers started coming on, then phones started coming on, and you would start seeing, the minute we started getting personal computers, crime started happening on them, where we get phones and people are using them for crimes. But in the last 15 years is when we started with it at the Lafayette Police Department, seeing it on our cases and utilizing it on our as evidence in our cases.
And I think ultimately that led to what became our high-tech crime unit, I think, that we kind of put together to dive into all this digital evidence. Why don't we talk about, you know, what is our high-tech crime unit? How does it function? Who all does it involve?
So the high-tech crimes unit is run by the Tippecanoe County Prosecutor's Office. They're the lead agency on that. And elements from the various local departments, the Tippecanoe County Sheriff's Department, the Lafayette Police Department, West Lafayette Police Department, Purdue Police Department, we put people there to work on evidence. We've quickly learned that buying the computers, the hardware, the software was very costly, very expensive. So instead of each department having their own unit, the prosecutor gets funding from the state of Indiana to run it, and we can go there and use that equipment and work together. The biggest benefit is the sharing of knowledge. I specialize in cell phones and Windows PCs. We have other people who specialize in maybe networking, or they specialize in Mac forensics. So there's different areas that we can specialize in, and it's hard to know everything. And if you have a question, you have a peer in that high-tech crimes unit who you can ask and get immediate feedback. We also do peer review. This is what I see. This is what I'm reporting on. Is it accurate? And I have peers that can look at that and give me feedback.
Yeah, and there's also a unique component to that, and that is the relationship with Purdue University. So the research university with researchers. So there's a side that is dedicated to sworn law enforcement, where the operational investigative part, and then there's a side which is the research part. So what that allows are researchers and students that have taken the classes to be able to come in and help out, not necessarily do the investigation, but look at, is there some type of technical support that needs to be done? Is it a type of technology that the unit hasn't seen before? Is it something that is really kind of busy work, but it will take a lot of hours for an investigator to do? The students can run and do some of that stuff. And it allows our researchers access to some of the real data, cleaned up, of course, and anonymized, and also helps us look at what are some of the things that we need to cover in our classes. We want to make sure that our students coming through our major at Purdue are actually, you know, prepared to work in the field. And it's one thing to have the theory in the class, but it's another thing to say, well, this is how you really do it in the real world. And this is the next set of knowledge, skills, and abilities that we're going to need in the next 2 to 3 years. And so we try to ramp those students up to be ready to do that.
And having the university involved in this is huge, because they bring that level of support to us. We are inundated with cases, and we're constantly working cases. And as Dr. Rogers says, when we have something and we're not sure what it is, the students can research that and provide us with an answer.
So Dr. Rogers, do you mind giving us an introduction of who you are and how you fit in all this?
Yeah, Mark Rogers, and actually I've been at Purdue now for 21 years. I'm actually ex-law enforcement from Canada, so I was in a computer crime unit up in Canada long before it was cool to be doing this stuff, and at that point it was mostly credit cards. That was the big investigation. Cell phones weren't quite as widespread as they are now, so we started off with credit card fraud and stuff like that. So when I came to Purdue to start up the program, having ex-law enforcement, you know, and we actually had a student that came through that had actually ties to the Lafayette PD, and we decided, you know what? This is something that we really need to partner with the law enforcement community. So LPD was more than willing to partner with us and say, hey, yeah, we'd love to work on that. So my background, like I said, is in law enforcement, also in research and sitting on some of the standards committee and tool development. So it was a really, really good partnership, because we could take, like I said, some of that theoretical and background and then combine it with the, you know, with a practitioner approach to doing this.
And I know you two go way back. How far back, and how did you guys get connected? And tell us a little bit about your first case.
The first case that we started working on was in 2005, when Danlee Chen, she murdered her husband, and his name was Leahy. And in that crime scene, there was a computer, and the computer was laying on its side, had been disconnected. And I collected it as a piece of evidence. But even though that physical computer has a hard drive in it, I didn't really know what to do with that hard drive. I didn't have that knowledge. So I approached Dr. Rogers at the university. There was another person working there at the time named Scott Cassander, and they worked on it together, and we were able to pull data off of that hard drive. And that was the first computer that I know that we did together at the Lafayette Police Department and on a homicide case. After that, we've had additional cases. When the iPhone 3 came out in 2008, we had another homicide in 2010, and the tools I had were able to access it. I take it to Purdue. There was a method out. It was kind of revolutionary at the time in 2008, called the Zdarsky method, to get a physical extraction of an iPhone 3. We did it in Dr. Rogers' lab over there in Kenoy Hall, and the information gained off of that phone was extremely beneficial in the prosecution of the two people who had committed that homicide. And then there was other data that we got on that as well, location data from cell tower records that I believe Dr. Rogers worked on as well.
Yeah, and I think that was, if I'm not mistaken, I think that was one of the first times where that much digital evidence was being entered into court. And they really didn't know, you know, the prosecutors putting this through, and the courts didn't really know, well, how do we do this? How much weight? So I think they actually set some precedent for the use of digital evidence in the courts in Indiana. And like I said, it was a great experience. We had students working on this. We were lucky enough to actually have a relationship with the individual Zdarsky who had done that. We had actually had him guest lecture remotely in the class, so we were able to kind of, you know, tap into him and say, okay, we want to do this. Because at that point, the tools were not as focused on cell phones. Back then, it was mainly, you know, your PCs or your laptops. Phones were relatively new, especially kind of the smartphone. So the tools didn't really focus on that, so we had to come up with another way. Once we got that evidence, we could plug it into the tools, but it was, how do we get this out in a way that is accurate and in a way that the courts are not going to say we damaged something or changed something. So that was a big part of that, is really setting some precedent in Indiana.
You're right. And the prosecutor Harrington at the time told us, this is the first time, not just in Tippecanoe County, but in the state of Indiana, that we had that much digital evidence. We had more digital evidence in that case than we had physical evidence. The physical evidence was just limited. And having to get that admitted, it was all admitted without issue. None of it was thrown out. And the prosecutor had to do the research. And as Dr. Rogers says, set the precedent for the state of Indiana of how evidence is submitted in a criminal case.
But this was really like the first digital opportunity in the county or all in the state?
Probably in the state for looking at the fact that the weight of the digital evidence was more than the physical evidence. So usually it's just used to basically corroborate something or as additional. But I think, it's safe to say that that was the meat and potatoes of the prosecutor was this digital evidence. And that had never been done before.
Yeah.
And it had never been done in a way where it wasn't just law enforcement had gone through it. They had gone to a university. So we had to look at chain of custody and were we doing those things correctly. And that was all new. To the courts, they hadn't seen that, and so there was a lot of, making sure we did it really right because we knew that there was nothing that they can go back that it should be done like this. We were kind of setting the standard, so we wanted to make sure. And there's been occasions, especially if you look at that relationship, that wasn't just unique in Indiana; that was unique in the entire United States. In fact, the Attorney General's office, U.S. Attorney General's office, has looked at our model, and it's not just been replicated in Indiana now with what 10. HDCUs in the last few years, but it is actually, they're trying to replicate it across the U.S. because of how effective it was at helping out, and it allowed some of the smaller agencies other than just the great big metropolitan areas that have big budgets to be able to offset the costs of doing this with the equipment, because for the most part, you need specific tools that the courts have seen to do this, and they're not cheap. So the training, the cost of this, and being able to not just have to rely on sworn investigators, but that was kind of one of the first civilian models to come over and help out with that. And that was very, very much, that we basically set the standard for the U.S.
Wow. So how you started off with a iPhone 3, how has digital evidence analysis evolved since then?
The phones have gotten smarter and
too smart.
Yeah. So we would get some flip phone or our feature phone is what you might call that. And we could plug it in and we could get at that time 10 text messages. That's all it would hold. And when the next text message came in, the oldest one would drop off. And so we were making sure that, we were training people back then in 2008. Make sure that you try to put that phone in airplane mode so that they don't get to the jail and call their phone 10 times and the text messages fall off. But we were only dealing with 10 text messages at a time and a few images. So the data that we were getting off was a very small data set. And now we hook up an iPhone or an Android and we have 100 gigabytes of data, 100,000 images from a phone. 40,000. I remember I did a case with 40,000 text messages, and I thought that was huge. And now it's not a lot. You'll have 4,000 threads with each thousands of messages in them because people won't delete things, or they'll set their phone not to delete their text messages.
Right. Yeah. I probably have like 20 gigabytes of text in my phone.
And it's a generational thing too. More of these kids use their phones than use personal computers now because that's everything. And you can get phones now with a terabyte of storage. That is equivalent to what a computer was a couple of years ago. It's just a huge amount. And then you have social media, and then you have the cloud, and then you have the Internet of Things, that's a weird term. I don't like it because it doesn't mean anything. You have smart devices. So now you've got the health apps that run off your watch. They're keeping track of blood pressure and heart rate and oxygen levels. And then you've got, you've got smart garage door openers and thermostats and smart beds. And we actually did some research on some smart socks. Like literally socks you put on and you can get the heart rate and pulse from the sock. All that is potential evidence. In fact, some of that health information has been used to show when a person actually had gone in and murdered the other person because the heart rate went up. There was a scuffle going on for 10 or 15 minutes. We could figure out where they are from a geolocation. So it's just The amount of potential evidence is huge on the phones. It's not just on the devices, it's in the cloud. And we used to pretty much do this by hand. We were able to go through by hand and kind of, those days are gone. It's automated tools. Now the big term is, you know, machine learning. And what it's doing is it's saying, you know, you've got way too much for any one of the analysts to look at in their lifetime, potentially. What do they need to focus on? So it does a triage and says, okay, we think that this is the most important stuff to look at. And then the analysts are able to basically look at that. And hopefully, you know, it's not so huge that they get completely overwhelmed.
Right.
But that's so, like I said, the volume, the type, because there's always new technologies coming out. And even where is this stuff? Even the phones now, a lot of the information is not just on the phone. It's in the cloud. It's sitting on, you know, the iCloud. It's sitting on Google. And now you can't just take the device. And even if there's nothing on the device, you still have to say, well, what's in the cloud? And trying to get that information. And then it's like, well, where is that cloud located? What's the jurisdiction? Can we actually issue a court order for information that's sitting in Ireland? Because that's where some of these things end up. So it's really interesting. But I'll tell you, the analysts are probably seeing a huge change.
I'll give you one of our cases. It was a homicide from a couple years ago. And the deceased had a pacemaker. And with the assistance of the Tippecanoe County Coroner's Office, we had to get with the manufacturer of that pacemaker, and the manufacturer could tell us when that person was killed because of the data that was on the pacemaker that was inside the body and recovered during autopsy.
Wow.
That was a first for me. I had never seen that, but that was digital evidence from a pacemaker that was in a body of one of our victims.
Right.
And it was crucial. It was crucial because we had the suspect on video at a certain time, which corresponded to the time of death from the pacemaker.
Another big area is automobile forensics now.
Yes.
So now it's basically, you know, it's not just the infotainment systems that you can look at and say, well, who's, you know, what's going on. There is the black boxes on those cars, and there's the ability now to go through, and you can get where they went, what was hooked up, the conversations, the texts, because now they become a smart device in the console, and that is the next big trend. And there's training, and I think we've had a couple of cases in the HTCU where basically information out of the car has been used to try and put the suspect at a certain location at a certain time, and it's been used to basically, well, your alibi doesn't stack up, because unless the car was driving itself and it's not a self-driving car,
right,
you were there and your phone was connected to it.
Yeah.
So also on that black box, that will have speed and braking information. So even your standard crashes, or a crash that's may have some criminal element to it, could be used. But that's the information that we know is going to be in these cars. And everything we do, everything we've talked about, requires a search warrant or some exception to that Fourth Amendment exceptions. But we're constantly getting search warrants to get that information. We know it exists, and knowing what is out there and knowing how to get it and who to ask for and how to write that search warrant is also another aspect. You could have a person who's full-time and all they did was write search warrants for this because it's so specialized.
And with the search warrants, if you don't use the exact wording, if you don't ask for the exact stuff, they're not going to tell you. They might actually have it, but it's called something different. They're not going to come back and say, well, we have it, but it's actually... If what you ask for is what they will go back and say, we don't have it. So even knowing what they should have, and that's other research we're doing right now, is looking at what do we know that they will have in their cloud so that law enforcement knows exactly what to ask for. Because if you don't ask for it, they're not obligated to tell you, well, it's something different. They'll just answer back and say, we don't have it.
Yeah.
So Matthew, let me ask you, I'm sure a lot of this that we talk about is time sensitive in nature.
Yes.
Talk about how that plays in the process, you know, how much time you guys spend doing this stuff, the challenges you run into, kind of just that angle of it.
So you're kind of always under some sort of time crunch because, you know, from when a case starts, like if we had a homicide or something, devices are going to be collected by the detectives. They'll be brought into the lab and say, hey, we need everything off that. And you have to know, okay, everything means I need everything about this case, about this person, what we're trying to do. So in the meantime, they may have gotten the search warrants already, and we have time limits on that. We also run into issues that, you know, if a phone is not connected or it is connected to networks, we run into the problem that it could be wiped remotely or anything. So we always try to get it in there and get the forensic process started as quickly as possible because we don't want to lose evidence. And then it's a matter of just going through the huge volume of data you might have on a phone. And one of the things that a lot of people don't realize is, yeah, we may be going through a terabyte worth of data. However, we also have to have a computer that supports going through a terabyte of data. And your off-the-shelf computers, which we've run into several times, they will crash and they just can't process it. They're not made for that. So a lot of the computers we use are specially made for this purpose. They're beefy.
So we know so much is involved in a case, and digital evidence has become a major factor in that. Do you have one case in mind specifically where we can go step by step, you know, the collection of evidence, what all happened at the HTCU?
So if you want to keep with the Zaragoza case, mm-hmm. The victim, unfortunately, the victim was a local drug dealer and he was selling weed. And Zaragoza knew this, and he enlisted his friend Jeremiah Thomas to go over there and rob him. When the victim answered the door, he was shot in the chest with a .40 caliber handgun, and we collected the bullet and the shell casing from the scene. The victim was able to retreat back into his house where he died. But the evidence there was limited. There was a lot of bloodstain pattern analysis where you could see as the victim was bleeding, you could see how he retreated into this house. Mm-hmm. We could see the bullet, and the forensic tool examiner, firearm examiner, looked at that bullet and noticed it had rifling in the form of 5 lands and grooves with a right-hand twist. And at that time, I don't know since that time, but at the time, only Smith & Wesson 40 caliber or 10 millimeter handguns used right-hand twist with 5 lands and grooves. So we knew the type of gun that our suspect had. The deceased's girlfriend told us that she left between 7:30 a.m. and 7:45. She left the house. She had checked her emails, and she logged off on her computer. And when I looked at the computer, I can see that log-off time, and I could see she had accessed her email account. But the log-off time corresponded with what she told us. So it helped corroborate it that our witness was telling us the truth. Mm-hmm. We also looked at the phone from the victim, and we could see where he was using the phone at a certain time. And then we started getting unread messages, missed phone calls, and no user-generated activity at a certain time. So we could say that from 7:35 and I think to about 10 or 10:30 is when most likely this person was shot, that our victim was shot, because there was no activity on his phone. And that's how we tried to determine what's called post-mortem interval or time since death. Mm-hmm. So those two pieces were the most critical, well, I don't say the most critical, were very important. As Dr. Rogers kind of talked about, the cell phone tower data was acquired, and you worked on that. I didn't work on the cell phone tower data. I worked on the cell phones, on the victim's cell phone. I worked on the suspect's phone, which was that iPhone 3, and getting stuff to the lab and determining what type of firearm was used. And again, we said that the iPhone 3 that Dr. Rogers and I worked on, even though some of the information had been deleted, we got it back. And we could see on the suspect's phone, he was looking to purchase a Smith & Wesson 40 caliber. He Googled searched it. We could see the Google searches. He inquired of what does one cost? He texted people who had them for sale, or he thought, but he was set on a Smith & Wesson 40 caliber. That information was also relevant because a day or two before the death, he's searching for that exact gun, that exact firearm to purchase one. Mm-hmm. And I'll let you talk about the location data from the cell phone towers.
Yeah, and at that point, there wasn't a lot of information on the phones itself related to the cell towers. But you could go to the company AT&T, whoever it was, and they could basically, once you knew the phone number and the information that makes the phone unique, they could actually run, as long as you did within a certain amount of time, they could go back and run their logs and say, yes, this is the activity of that phone on that day. And the phones are constantly, even if you're not talking on it, they're constantly polling towers to say, this is the cell that I'm in. So if you have to make a call, it's already ready to go. So we were able to get the information from the cell company, and we were able to basically, it was a manual process. We actually had to go then and map it back onto something like Google Earth and show this is where the phone was pinging off those towers. So we're able to basically show and basically that in, you know, the individuals had been in a car because of how fast, driving from Indianapolis, coming up the highway, going basically coming into the development where the victim was, and we could get the times, and they were corresponding to this. And then there's that, you know, space and time where nothing's happening. And one of the cell towers was luckily was very close to the, you know, the victim. So that definitely was within a certain radius of distance between, and then them getting back in their vehicle and then driving back down. And the times matched with the times that they had. And it was basically, it's like, well, why were you up there? So now they couldn't say that they weren't, at least the person who had that phone couldn't say, I wasn't there.
Right.
Because the evidence proved that they were, and the evidence showed that they were there at that point in time in that exact location.
And Zaragoza had an alibi. He said his alibi was that he went to his mother's house, which was near there, but it wasn't covered by the cell tower that he was pinging off of. So where the victim was and where the shooting occurred, pretty much one cell tower at that time covered it, but it didn't cover his mother's house. So we could disprove his alibi that he wasn't at his mother's house because he wasn't, he was pinging off the wrong cell phone tower.
Right.
And as Dr. Rogers says, that time from when Zaragoza and Thompson drove from Indianapolis up here, were pinging off the cell tower at the victim's residence, also matched the time that I had from the victim's cell phone of when he was using it and then when he stopped using it. And it was very, very close in that time frame. But that was, again, the physical evidence was limited. But having that digital evidence, and to give credit where it's due, the other detectives worked up victimology. When we had nothing else to go on, we started looking at the victim. Who is our victim? Why would someone want to rob him? Who are his friends? Who knows things? And I don't know the number. I lost count of the number of individuals that were interviewed. I think there were like 60 individuals who were interviewed to try to get information to piece us all back together that led us to the two suspects. So the other detectives on this case, not just Dr. Rogers and I, we're not the heroes of this case. That was a team effort by people at the Lafayette Police Department, retired Sergeant B.T. Brown, and other people who worked on that case were absolutely pivotal.
Yeah. Don't take your heroism away, though. You guys are still heroes. So how often, and what's the relationship between LPD and Purdue working on a case? When do you guys work together? When do you work separately?
We still get interns. So Dr. Rogers, do you want to talk about the majors that you offer for your students?
Yeah. We have a major, and then we have two specific classes that our students take that basically prepare them if they want to do internships. It's like a basic course on digital forensics, so they know how to use the tools, they know some of the rules of evidence and things. Now we have an investigative class that we do. So the students that come out of that program with a B or better now can actually apply to be an intern, unpaid intern, with basically the HTCU. And they end up, for the most part, spending most of their time working on the LPD cases. So they're really the LPD interns within the HTCU. Mm-hmm. And then those students are the ones that will be primarily helping out with these cases. But every so often, there's a, you know, they'll reach back to the faculty member, myself, or Dr. Kate, and say, hey, this is, you know, we're seeing something here. What do you know about it? And then we'll, you know, go talk to some other PhD students, some other faculty, and come back and say, we think this needs to be done. Or in some cases, we'll create our own tool to be able to go in there and do that. We've done that in a couple of cases where we've had to, okay, this database thing isn't really working right, so maybe we can do that. The other thing we do is we try to stay ahead of the curve as far as researchers go, because we know, you know, one nice thing about Purdue is it's an engineering computer science school. The kids are going to have the latest technology. They're going to have the latest, and we have international students. So we'll see phones coming in that nobody else really in the country has seen yet, because they were very big in Asia. They're big in Europe. But we know they're eventually maybe going to come to this marketplace. So we try to stay ahead. So we'll actually get software from Apple, the latest, you know, beta version of the iOS or Android, latest version of some phones that are coming over from Asia, or applications that are big over there. That a lot of them are the, you know, messaging applications used to be really big in Asia, and then they would hit the North American marketplace, and we'd see a lot of them because they weren't popular here. The vendors didn't have the software wouldn't know what to do with them because they just didn't have a big enough market share. So what we do is we do research on, okay, so we know that, you know, 3 months from now you're going to see this version of an iOS come out. What issues are the current tools going to have, and what do you need to do by hand, and how can you do it by hand, or what do we need to do? And we'll also get back to the vendors of the software and say, look, you're not doing this right. It works for this version, but it doesn't work for that version. And that's where the analysts come back and say, we know it's there, but we just can't get anything out of it. It's not working. So this is where we have the time as researchers or our students to try to do that. And then we try to pass that training on and say, hey, just so you know, this is going to come out. This is, you know, we're going to see this, and you can't rely on it to do this. You have to do X or Y. And if you don't have time to do it because you've got, you know, a million other things to do and, you know, 40,000 pictures, we'll have students that can do that for you.
So I monitor the interns as they come in. Dr. Rogers or Dr. Catherine Siegfried Speller, they nominate people, and we do a background investigation on them because they're actually working on our cases.
Right.
And we have different forms, confidentiality. But I may assign an intern to work with Aaliyah to whatever she may be working on. And we try to get them through the entire process from collecting an item. If we have a search warrant, they'll go out into the field with us during a search warrant. Collection, acquisition from the device, and then analysis. Or if we have a court case where we're testifying, everything we do has to be presented to the jury. And we try to show them all those different facets that we work on. Sometimes we don't get to everything in a semester, but we try to show them that.
Go
ahead, man.
I was gonna say, the thing that's really nice about the interns is, you know, since they're taking the latest and greatest classes, they actually end up teaching us kind of some of this newer stuff, you know, what's coming down the pipe, because they're having time to study that. They're working with Dr. Rogers. So it's really a two-way street. I mean, hey, it sounds cheesy to say we learn as much from them as they do from us, but it's a very positive program.
Yeah, like I was wondering how you guys keep up with all of the latest trends and advanced security, but it sounds like Purdue's on it.
We are, but you know, while we learn, you know, while they're, you know, our interns are learning from them, we are also learning, coming back and saying, well, okay, so maybe we have to adjust our classes because, yes, we think that, you know, this is good, but we didn't realize that the software is not doing that, or, we're not really teaching them how to do that, but if they're going to be valuable in, you know, for you folks to do, you know, to do this, that's a skill that we then need to include into our curriculum. So it keeps our curriculum honest, so to speak, for lack of a better term. Okay. It's one thing to, you know, we like the theory being, you know, faculty and researchers, but this is a very applied area. So we need to make sure that what we're teaching them is actually what needs to be done, what's happening, what's the latest, you know, court ruling on this or rules of evidence. And that's where the HCCU educates us on how to do that.
So for me, I don't often use Snapchat. So when I get a Snapchat case and I see things, it's like, how does this work? I have subject matter experts, which are my children, who use it. And my children are college age. They just graduated college. And they would help me go through Snapchat of what I was seeing or how did this happen? Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, Dad, that's easy. And or the interns can go through, oh, yeah, we've used Snapchat or WhatsApp or whatever application is new that I haven't heard of that I don't have on my phone. They're my subject matter experts on that. And Aaliyah is the younger generation that's coming on too, and she will show me and teach me how to use those things. I can do file system level stuff, but I'm not a Snapchat user, so.
You don't have an Instagram account?
I don't even have an Instagram account.
Do you at least have Facebook?
I have no social media accounts.
Then that he knows of. We may have created some fake ones every once in a while.
Well, you're right. I think you call them the sock puppet accounts.
Yep.
So there are times when a victim comes to us and says, hey, we want you to look at this. I've been victimized online, and we have accounts that we can go and see that with. But personally, I don't keep them around because I don't need to put my stuff out there. And if I need to look at something, I'll creep on my wife's page. Other than that, I don't get on there.
So Leah, you've been pretty quiet. Let's bring you in real quick.
Oh, okay.
So I heard you say you became interested in CSI because of the show. So is it similar or is it different? What are your thoughts?
Well, I'd say no, in the fact that a lot of the episodes I've seen or watched,
they're more exciting than this?
Yeah, and the technology's way more advanced now compared to the show back then. I don't even know what years they came out, but definitely there's generationally more updated technology now, and I didn't realize how much technology plays into my position that I'm in currently. Mm-hmm. But there's a lot of devices that I wouldn't even think that we would investigate, like as far as like even cameras and
like the socks.
Surveillance. Yeah, even socks. I would never think to that we would possibly have that in the future, but we might be getting socks. Who knows? But it's really interesting to see like how the position is actually done like in real life time and in my what I do now compared to what I would see. But yes, a lot of every crime, I've not seen one crime not have any technology. Everyone has a cell phone. Everybody seems to have a lot of surveillance systems. Thank you. Surveillance systems. So we don't ever have a case where there's no evidence of digital involved. So,
So what type of crime would you say you work with the most? Would you say like e-crime, like hacking or fraud, or like actual physical crime with digital evidence?
So we do both. So I'm also a crime scene investigator. I've taken classes for crime scene investigator through the International Association of Computer Investigative Specialists. I have a certification as a certified forensic computer examiner and other certifications. So we do both the physical crime scene and the digital crime scene. So they're having us do two jobs here. And Aaliyah and Matt, Aaliyah's still training. But Matt has been doing digital forensics for a while, but as a cop for 16 years, he understands the physical crime scene. But also, that phone is a physical device. And so we need to know how to acquire that, how to package it, how to do those physical devices in a forensically sound manner so that we can keep them in court. But as far as the type of crimes, every shooting, every homicide, location data on their phones. As you said, these surveillance cameras are everywhere. Everyone has a Ring camera. Everyone has some type of camera. We had an arson where a man set his neighbor's truck on fire. And we look up, and when we get to a crime scene, the first thing we do is start looking for cameras. And we look up, and we see the suspect has cameras on the outside of his house. And we got a search warrant, and we got his own surveillance system that He recorded himself lighting the man's truck on fire. And that was an easy case to solve when he records himself videotaping an arson. But one of the first things we do, and I've told Aaliyah and our crime scene investigators, is start looking for these cameras. And we've solved a lot of cases just by getting the videos. And we've trained our patrol officers to do that as well.
I think the scary trend and a good trend that we're going to see is artificial intelligence. And we're seeing now where actual things are being developed that are not, they don't exist in reality, like child porn, which is basically AI generated, deep fakes of people doing things that they didn't do. So that's becoming, you know, very problematic. One, what is the law related to AI? Because that was never around when these things were the laws were being developed. And then how do you investigate? How do you tell whether that is a real video or it's a deep fake? It used to be pretty easy at one point because the technology was pretty crude. Now it's to the naked, you can't tell. So there's specialized software you have to use to do it. So we're starting to see kind of AI generated, crimes that need to be investigated. At the same time, we're seeing that same AI being used in the forensics tools simply to be able to go through and learn like an investigator learns, so it can better understand what is evidence, what needs to be done, what you might be looking for. And you can train it, especially when you start looking at pictures and videos. You get a case with a million pictures in it and you're looking for somebody with a certain ring. The human being is not going to be able to do that. You can train the system to go out in there and now using AI to be able to focus in and then enhance backgrounds, do things like that. So it's causing us issues as far as the type of criminal offenses that it's now being able to create. And then it's helping us with actually having smarter tools to help the investigators.
So we didn't mention it prior. We've mentioned our homicides and arsons. But Matt, Aaliyah, and I were all members of the Indiana ICAC, Indiana Internet Crimes Against Children. We're investigators for that. The child sexual assault material, people who trade pictures and videos of children being abused, it's huge, and it's something that we work a lot on. It's terrible. It's disturbing, and I wish we could focus more time on that. We will have a new position coming here at LPD for another investigator, digital investigator. Hopefully we can add more to that. We've increased what we've done in the last year, but those internet crimes against children are disturbing. And it's one of the cases where when you find someone and save a child from that abusive relationship, it's very satisfying. It's something that I wish I could do full time. Because it's so vile. I can't imagine my children doing, or any child, being involved in that type of abuse. So I think that's important also to get out there, that something we should focus on more.
Definitely.
Because they're true victims in every sense of the word. I mean, these are images and videos taken of the worst day of their lives that is being traded around online by people. And if we have a chance to intercept that, we're going to do it.
And the really kind of egregious thing is they're not victims just when it happened to them. They're victims every time that video gets shown, that picture gets shared. So they're victims for life. So they're being re-victimized for the rest of their lives. And the psychological toll that takes on these people is horrible. So it's, like I said, it's such an important, but it is just almost overwhelming, simply because of the technology didn't create the crime, but it really allows the trading, and that's assumed anonymity makes people more bold to do things. So it's really just kind of it's exploded. And it's something that really is, it could take up 200% of the HTCU's time, but like everything else, there's these other cases that need to be looked at as well.
Yeah. And just the amount of time that goes into one of those cases. I mean, you're looking probably 40, 50 hours easy before you even are making contact with a suspect.
So let's continue really quickly on this subject. When you are notified of this subject out there, What's your process? Like, can you pinpoint the location?
So what we do, like any other crime, we start gathering information right away. So initially we'll receive what's called a cyber tip from the National Center of Missing and Exploited Children in conjunction with the Indiana State Police, who runs the ICAC here in Indiana. We will download the tip, which will also include some of the material that was being traded, so that we can first confirm, hey, this is illegal. It is not supposed to happen, because you do get false positive results. And, you know, you don't want to go forward on a case and build a criminal case against somebody who is not doing something illegal. So we confirm that. And then we start looking at electronic service provider information, whether it's, you know, getting IP data or reaching out to Google and serving search warrants for data on that end. As we get all that back in the coming weeks, we go through all of it and see, okay, is there any more of this data there? Are they trading it with anybody? Are they possessing it? Do we have any more identifying information on this person? We build up as much as we can before that. We also jump into doing open source intelligence gathering on these people. We have a crime analyst here at LPD, Paul Kuban. He helps out quite a bit on that and helps dig when it comes to social media. So we get as much as we can for that. Before we go and make contact with a suspect or anything, we will get search warrants for whatever the location may be, whether it's a business or a house or something. But before we do anything, a prosecutor reviews that. They take a look at it and make sure everything is in the proper order. That it's called a probable cause affidavit, goes in front of a judge. A judge who is not involved in this case whatsoever, has no connection to it, takes a look at it and says, hey, does this meet the standard for probable cause to issue a search warrant for this residence? So there's kind of a misnomer sometimes, like when you watch these shows like CSI, that, hey, a crime's happened. Okay, we can go boot a door and go do this. No, they're showing you the tip of the iceberg. The rest of it is much more, there's a lot of back work done on that. So then after that, then, you know, we're interviewing suspects, interviewing individuals.
The children, if there's children involved, if there's, yes, we're interviewing them.
We will get search warrants for devices, content, anything. The investigation continues after that. It doesn't, things don't stop at an arrest. From the point that we serve that warrant to when charges get filed to when it goes to trial, the investigation continues. And we'll be working closely with our partners at the prosecutor's office, who are really great, and they keep up to date on all the changing laws with us. So I know that's kind of like the long-winded answer, but like Paul said, it's something that I think we all feel very passionately about, that mm-hmm. this is a serious crime. It warrants our attention, and you're helping the most helpless victims, which is what we all got into this to do.
Yes. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, before we completely wrap up every episode, we answer some viewer questions. So we have some specific CSI ones today. And into the first one.
All right. Do you utilize artificial intelligence to assist with cases, and if so, how?
Oh, funny, we already answered that.
Yes. And how we do it is in a couple of different ways. Primarily, it is baked into the vendor tool that's out there. About the past year and a half, while the generative AI and ChatGPT has been big, the machine learning component which builds that has been built into some of that for doing image recognition, for basic
media categorization. Yep. Is what we often use it for.
Yeah, we can actually use it. You can actually get it, so it will go through and it'll look through 40,000 pictures and it'll identify pictures that have a truck in it, pictures that have a bottle in it, a gun, or illicit drugs, or for, you know, from the point of looking at CSAM material, naked skin. Or now we can get it, tell the difference between a boy and a girl in these pictures. So that it's baked into that. We also use it in another way, and that's for the development of some of the tools that just aren't out there yet. So we leverage a lot of that same technology to basically develop tools that we know law enforcement needs but just aren't on the marketplace. And those tools are free. We don't charge for them.
So would you say AI is almost 100% accurate in identifying things?
It's never 100%, but it's actually just as accurate, if not more, than a human. but in about a thousandth of the time. So what would take an analyst sometimes, you know, 3 days to do can be done in 10 seconds.
Sure. And so if I have some type of gun-related crime and I have, as Dr. Rogers said, 40,000 images, and I ask the software to find all the images with a gun, it may cut, instead of having to look through 40,000 pictures, it may cut that down to a few thousand, a couple hundred. But then I still have to go right. through and see, well, is this something relevant to my case? And not only pictures, but the videos as well. People always want to do selfies and take videos with their guns.
And their money.
Yeah. And but it's a time saving. It's eliminated the stuff I don't need to look at and focus on what I should be looking at.
And the way the law reads it is a tool can't testify in court. It can't be an expert witness. It still requires the human to look at this and go, yes, I verify that is, and that is something good. We don't want the courts to ever accept something that is completely automated without the human piece of it going through and filtering that, because we just do a better job at that point than the artificial intelligence can do.
Next up, what is your favorite type of evidence to work with?
I think that's a Leah question, right?
As far as digital evidence,
take it as you will.
Well, truly anything could be evidence, like a pencil, a camera, anything. So I'm going to say, as far as the most interesting piece of evidence that I consistently work with, I will say is a cell phone. Everybody has a cell phone. The things that people look up, the things that people take pictures of, the choices of discussions people choose to have. I mean, it's pretty much got all the juicy information stored on it. I guess.
Can just see you guys in the lab laughing over something.
Yeah.
What's funny is people put stuff on there because they never think somebody else is going to
exactly. look at it. Exactly. Yeah.
So I know we did the stats for 2023 and Aaliyah attended 34 autopsies. She was at an autopsy this morning. So even that body, that person who died, that body is a piece of evidence. So she works with the coroner's office of the pathologist a lot, and she works with that a lot. I just don't know if that's her favorite piece of evidence.
Yeah, it is a piece of evidence I work with constantly. Probably about once a week at this point, there's an autopsy, unfortunately, but it is a piece of evidence I work with on a consistent manner, as well as phones, because everybody has a phone.
All right. How do you keep up with rapidly evolving technology and operating systems?
Well, I think Dr. Rogers covered that. It's difficult. It's difficult for us when we're going to autopsies, when we're going to crime scenes, when we're working on cases. But when we get that new piece of technology, I have to ask the interns. I have to ask Leah to use this application.
Or Google.
Or there's a lot of different Forensic Monkey is out there. Forensics is another one, I think, that we go and have other people online, or we go to the university and say, what do you know about this? We try to find some type of research or white paper. Dr. Rogers has associates who may be studying this and may know something. But those are the different resources that are available to us. We also, as I said earlier, talk about peer review. I have listservs. I can go out on the listserv, and if I'm seeing it, some digital evidence investigator somewhere has seen it, and it's probably on our listserv that we have access to.
I think that's probably the most challenging part of the digital forensics that's different than the regular forensics. You don't have DNA 2.0 coming out tomorrow, right? Or a new version. I mean, we have to do a bug fix to your blood type. We get that constantly with digital evidence. So literally the type of evidence, how we do it, can change day to day because something's come out. Technology is always changing. And a version that basically you understood last week changes next week, and it's suddenly changed enough now that you have to go in and kind of refigure out what it's doing. So that's the biggest challenge, is the constantly changing technology.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that'd be tough. And I think we have one more. On average, how many gigabytes of data do you sort through in a day?
Oh, gosh. That's you, Matt.
Well, you know, any phone, it's pretty common for any phone now to be at least 128 gigs. Yeah. And we're probably doing at least one phone a day. But we've seen them as big as 512. And Dr. Rogers even talked about 1 terabyte. When you're dealing with a computer, it can be multiple terabytes, especially if you've got a lot of people with these advanced gaming rigs and stuff where they have a massive amount of data. Mm-hmm. They can have 10 terabytes in there with no problem. And once again, we're just trying to find the tools and the way to sort through that as quickly and efficiently as possible.
So do you need a super huge hard drive to sort through not everything, only, or is it all external?
Not only a big hard drive, but graphics cards are important now, mm-hmm. and CPUs, which is the central processor, have to be beefed up. Mm-hmm. So like I said, we kind of model the computers that we use after a lot of these gaming rigs that have, you know, the great graphics cards and stuff. We don't go to Walmart and buy something off the shelf because it just, you can't open it.
Right. And then there's the archiving of all that stuff. Yeah. So it's a huge amount of storage because it's going to go to court at some point in time. Between time A and when it's going to court, it's got to be stored somewhere. It's got to be stored somewhere that has the chain of custody and admissibility. So there's the huge storage thing. And then when the case is over, you can't just necessarily throw it out because there could be an appeal. So it's got to be stored for 1 year, 2 year, 5 year, yeah. 10 year, and it's got to be accessible. So it starts increasing the cost for storage because you have to keep adding all this stuff on top of it. So it's a huge amount of archiving and storage of the data once you actually finish processing it.
You will never take less storage every year because you're just, with these devices getting bigger, you've got to have it. And I think we've got records on cases from like 2009 still that we have to keep because, you know, there's court appeals and stuff and it takes time.
Right. You know, I remember growing up and using my mom's 128 megabyte USB stick.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
My first computer was 4 megabytes. And I remember thinking, man, how would you ever fill that?
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Way too much storage.
Man. Right.
Yeah. You couldn't have enough of those, what, the Kong game or the gorilla throwing the barrel.
Donkey Kong, yeah.
High tech.
Oh.
That was gaming at its finest.
All right, well, that's all the questions we have. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Yeah, thank you.
Yes, thank you.
And I'd like to thank the chief and the mayor for giving us another position to help with that. And thank you for Dr. Rogers and his team for helping us with these crimes that we together are solving.
And the city council for all their support. And prosecutors, this is not a one-person game. There are a lot of people involved in this.
And right. Purdue does this for free. This is part of our land grant mission to give back to this, you know, the taxpayers of the state of Indiana, and the university and the administration is very much behind that. The space that we have provided, the space before and the space now, is no cost to anybody. That's donated by the university, and then so is the faculty's time, because we see that as an important mission of our university.
Right. So for listeners who are wanting to join this program, LPD is opening up another civilian position, so be on the lookout for announcements about that. Dr. Rogers, if they are interested in joining the program at Purdue, how do they find more about
it? Go on Google, Cyber Forensics Purdue, and you'll get the landing page to the lab, and there's information on there about contacts, and just email us, and we'd be more than happy to put you in touch with some of the folks that are part of the recruitment.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. You want to take us out?
Yep. That'll do it for this episode. We'll be back for our next monthly episode, drop the first of every month. So thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you next time. For now, Inside the Squad, 1042.